We're going on with Revelation today. I think things are coming clearer in the book. And I think as we proceed here, I feel more confidence than I have ever before that by the time we get through with this book, we'll have some understanding of the situation. I don't mean that absolutely, and I don't mean that I'm infallible, but I just mean that things are beginning to clarify themselves to us. I was just thinking yesterday, of course, you know, we're just like a family here. I don't ever give sermons, addresses. I just talk with you. In fact, I suppose your most significant advantage in hanging in there with myself is ideational. That is idea-oriented rather than emotion-oriented, and certainly not superstition-oriented or miracle-oriented. That doesn't mean to say that God does not do things for us that are rather miraculous in nature, as I think He does. I'm quite certain He does. But you see, the word miracle is actually a sign. The miracles that Jesus did in the Old Testament were signs. A miracle is never used either A, to prove God, or B, to comfort the world, to make a better world. As far as the proofs are concerned, all the miracles did was not to prove to people that Jesus Christ had power. It was to prove to the remnant that were looking for the Messiah, it was to say that this was indeed the Messiah. They were already looking for the Messiah, see? It wasn't that they were proving that Jesus was a prophet. In fact, the Jewish people were well familiar with miracles from the prophets, but that this person, Jesus, was the Messiah. This is what was being proved. And certainly not at all that God exists or that there is power with God. I think that's a really crucial point to understand. The miracles never did prove to the non-believer that Jesus was God, or that God exists. And that's why in Capernaum it says he could there do no mighty works because of their unbelief. That wasn't to say that because they didn't have faith, he couldn't do a miracle for them. It was because they were not in the context that they would have listened to him anyway. See? When the believers got together and Jesus spoke to them, they could see that he was the Messiah. The second point was that the miracles were not primarily for the purpose of correcting the ills of the world. If they were, that would be quite a failure. Because he only did a moderately small number of things. He did not heal all of the deaf and dumb or the blind. He didn't alleviate poverty in the world. He did not eliminate poverty even from Jerusalem. In fact, toward the end of his ministry, he said simply, "The poor you have always with you." If the miracles were for the purpose of bringing comfort to the world, they were not that adequate. The miracles that he performed did comfort the people that received the miracle. But if you read the Gospels, and your conclusion from reading the Gospels is that if you have faith, you're going to get healed from whatever your illnesses are, if you do that, then you've missed the point. Now, once again, I clarify, it is not to say he does not do things today that are providential, that are remarkable, miraculous, if you want to use the term. But the primary meaning of miracle is as a sign, and we rather may talk of, even though we'll use it because the term has come to mean anything supernatural, but primarily it was only a sign. Now, you can pray today for healing and get healed. People get healed. Now, you can pray for other kinds of supernatural things and you can get help. If we take a cue from Jesus, it will comfort us a great deal in our approach to the faith. Why? Because you see, Jesus only healed a representative number of people and not all. And he never did put out the word that absolutely anybody who believed would be healed. He said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and it'll be done. That does not mean that all the mountains around us are in jeopardy if we have highly religious people. Poor skiers would be very uneasy if they thought that a concentration of praying people here could remove Mammoth Mountain. If God wanted to move a mountain, and you were the agent of that activity, that is, if you were the one praying for it, God wanted to do it, the confidence would be there for it to be moved. The fact that you don't have confidence, you cannot go, I submit to not anybody in this room can go over to the Angelus Crest and work up enough faith to get it knocked down. Because none of us have the slightest thought that God wants to do that. You see that? If you don't have any thought that God particularly wants to do a thing, you're not going to have faith for it. Now, the reason that's comforting is because as for persons like myself, where I'm constantly dealing with people in trouble, people in need, where the common attitude is, if we just pray and have faith, God will change this thing. Over all the years of my ministry, I've seen a great many things not changed. A great many things. I've seen some things changed. And a lot of things not changed. I cannot say to somebody, if you'll just pray, the Lord will remove your alcoholism. I don't know what the conditions are that will happen. I know that praying day in and day out for people has an effect. Paul says, God forbid that I should sin in ceasing to pray for you. That is to say, for us not to pray for one another is something that is unsound. That doesn't say how many. You don't have to pray for everybody, but people, Lord, gives you responsibility for, you should continue to pray. That doesn't mean you have to pray every minute, but just that you shouldn't quit praying for them. If you, the Lord puts them on your heart to pray for them, and you pray for them. But prayer is obviously effective. I've prayed for people, just probably the people I pray for without fail. Maybe once or twice in a year. I mean, on a day, it's just like brushing my teeth. There are certain people that I pray for. And I have seen those people go through very rough things. And I think to myself, what's the good of my praying? Look what happens to them. Then I find, well, maybe it all happened for the best. And later on, I find that things maybe worked out better because of that problem. Don't give up praying for people, but I cannot give you the formula of exactly how God is going to respond. I say that because it was apparently not ever God's intention to rectify all the ills of earth and make it a paradise for everyone to live in. In many circles of the church today, there are people that think that the business of the church is to correct all the ills of the world. They get into poverty programs and equality programs and everything else, and they feel that their social responsibilities are a part of their spiritual responsibilities. Well, that can be a pretty grinding thing. There's no end to it. If you say our responsibility is to heal everybody, see that everybody is healed and healthy and wealthy, and there are no poor on the earth, if that's our mission, we're not accomplishing it. But neither did Jesus accomplish it, and neither did the disciples accomplish it, the apostles. So, what is our mission? Can we look forward to as God's intention for things on the earth? Well, all I can figure out is that we have to just paddle our own canoe down the river. Primarily, when you come to this place, you receive help in terms of how do we live, how do we handle life day by day, how do we interpret faith, and you do not come primarily for an emotional lift. By that same token, you're going to, whatever we do here is going to last longer for you. But some have left the place because we didn't sing enough. Well, we sing one or two songs, but this is not our primary thought here to build up anything of an emotional lift. But I think people can get a pretty good lift from eating meat and potatoes, but it isn't ice cream and cake. So when you come here, I'm concerned with helping us to understand what our life is all about. The nature of God, the nature of man, the nature of the society we live in, what's going on in the world around us, how we relate to what's going on around us. Those are all the stuff of what I talk about here with you. So I don't rely on inspiration or anything that I, of emotional lift, but I think if you can get some peace in your life by seeing that you're on course, that's probably a better service to you. And you can get together and have your own sing-along if you want to, raise the roof, but that's not my task. My task is to help you understand, because if you understand what it's all about, you'll be more able to cope with your lives, and you'll be more at peace about it all. And that's why I take a lot of time with the political situation, especially the international situation, because I want to have you come to some degree of peace. Not false hope, not euphoria where you just shut your eyes to realities, but genuine and sensible evaluation of what's taking place in the world. In vis-a-vis the matter of looking at the world we live in and evaluating it, you see what has happened is this. The church has been so convinced that the Russians are the bête noire of the world, that is the dark knight, the nemesis of the world, that they've more or less assumed that they were Satan's people and just gave them over to Satan. It's like forgetting our the old days, everybody's being reminded not to forget the POWs or the MIAs, the missing in actions or the prisoners of war. It is assumed, because of the conventional wisdom today, that Russia is the great bear that's going to come in and wipe out the world. So nobody's going to pray for them anymore, because that's a lost cause. They're gone. I want to remind you that Russia was essentially a Christian nation for 1,000 years. That Russia was the sponsor of a thing called the Holy Alliance prior to World War I, back in the days of Metternich, 1850 area, which was I think it was Nicholas I that offered this, that all who joined that Holy Alliance would be declaring that they were going to try to run their affairs in keeping with the principles of Christianity. It was short-lived. It didn't really hold up too long, but it was a start. Russia has been Christian since about 1000 A.D. It was imported from Constantinople. Apparently, God was moving in the affairs of the world when he brought the split in Rome, where here is Rome, which was the most powerful, invincible empire on earth. There was none that could stand before it, and they had 200 years of the thing called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, which was so because the Roman forces were invincible. Nobody could come up against them. There was no war because nobody had the power to go up against Rome. Not too long after that, the whole thing blew up, divided, and Christianity was exported to what was then Byzantium by Constantine the Great. Now, Constantine did not actually become a Christian until after he was in power, but it was Constantine's move in 316 AD to Byzantium that paved the way for the Christianization of Russia. The communists have only been in there for 65 years, and everybody has assumed that the cause is lost, that 1,000 years of Christianity, now almost 2,000 years, because there's still been many, the church is not dead in Russia. All of this is swept under the rug by a few Marxian socialists. by a despotic process that uses socialism as a cover for their despotism. So after 65 years, we're going to give up the task, and we're going to say, well, the Russians are goners. Look at our own country, America. We first started colonizing here, settling here in about 1620. Massachusetts Bay Colony. We were here earlier than that, 1617, Jamestown. So Jamestown was earlier than that. But let's take 1620 as the viable beginning of, or the beginning of the viable colonizing process. We were under the thumb of the British Empire. And there were many, many problems, many actions by the British that, not to, at this point, criticize the British of today, our colleagues in the world arena, but to say that in those days, we were under the thumb of Britain. And by the time we got to our Declaration of Independence, George III was in power in England, and he was so despotic in his actions that if you want to read the Declaration of Independence, one-third of it about is given to the excesses of King George III. Part of the Declaration is a preamble suggesting the process of equality in the world, supporting the idea of equality and the consent of the governed, the interaction of the people in the government. A third of it is, or maybe more than a third, are grievances against King George III. The third part of it is the declaration of our intentions to be independent. That's what the Declaration is all about. Now, when did that come out? 1776. 1620 to 1776. So you've got 150-some years that we were under the thumb of England, even though we had come to establish a, by and large, Christian nation. The colonists came, the colonists came not only to establish a Christian nation, but also to establish the right not to be Christian if one wanted not to be. It was a dual, two-edged sword. It was a freedom that allowed people not to have to belong to a state church. But anyway, our predominant process or approach was Christianization. Yet we suffered under that for 100-some years, and finally were delivered from that in the Revolutionary War. And all I'm saying about it is, if a power has come in to oppress the church in Russia, and it's been oppressing them for 65 years, we of all people ought to understand that there may yet be hope for their deliverance. And to just give up and say, well, there's the great bear coming over the Ural Mountains, is not even sound. And the reason we do it is this wholesale pressure by would-be prophets today that declare that Russia now is the great nemesis of the world. That the Antichrist is coming out of there or whatever, and they're the power from the north. They have no place in the northern power structure of the Old Testament. Iran, Iraq, and Syria belong to the northern powers in the Old Testament, and they're shaping up today. I've said to people before, if tomorrow Russia came through and wiped us out, I'm going to say, well, I was wrong. So I'm not telling you this as a final absolute word. I'm just telling you this is the way it shapes up. When you look at the history of the world around us, and you compare that with the Bible, you do not come out with the idea that Russia is necessarily lost to Christ. I would like to enlist the aid of this group. I wouldn't try to enlist anybody outside of it because I think they might feel we'd lost our marbles, which is all right too. Who needs marbles? I'd like you to begin praying. I'm going to do that. I'm going to pray every day that the Lord will deliver Russia. It's a Christian nation that has gotten under the thumb of a demonic force. And maybe we can pray them free. Who knows? But don't assume that they've got to be part of that ultimate Holocaust. The more I read the book of Revelation, the more I feel what we're talking about here makes a lot of sense. Of course, all the countries that are listed in the prophetic studies of the Old and New Testament belong in the Middle East. Now today, you have a situation where Iran, which once we thought could not function apart from a Western coalition via the Shah, and we thought when the Shah was deposed that Iran would just go back to be a backward state because they were going to function totally within the Quran, which they have not really done. We didn't think they were going to last a whole lot longer. Then when Iraq started in on Iran, it was assumed that Iraq, with the backing of the Soviet Union and some others, would fairly readily overcome the Iranians. But it has not been so. I would have thought they would. But it has not been so. The Iranians have showed a rather strong reaction here, even though to them in the early stages it was a jihad, a holy war, the Iranians thought it was. Not the Iraqi. The Iraqi are Muslim, but not, they have a religious Muslim orientation, but they are not a Muslim state as such. They're not ruled by Muslim principles as Iran is. The Shiites are by far the most zealous, and they are religious zealots, and in the early stages of the war, they sent in wave after wave of what we would call cannon fodder, just bodies that were going in as dying for their faith. To them, it was a jihad, J-I-H-A-D. Well, whatever was their technique, at the present time, the conventional wisdom is, that is, those that are more or less specialists in the Middle Eastern situation, is that Iran very likely will take over, will win. Now, you see, Iraq is in the location of ancient Babylon. If there's ever going to be a revival of a Babylonian complex, the stage is set for it. You say, well, this isn't very spiritual. No, what it is trying to do is to help you get a footing in life so you don't run panicking to the caves or something. I'm trying to help you get your footing, and I'm trying to help us understand what's going on as far as the Bible is concerned, because I think maybe I can rescue the Bible as a valid book for you. If I can help you to see that the Bible does not go along with the wild-eyed predictions that go on today. I would lose faith in the Bible if I don't mean that I can outguess what God wants to do. I just mean that it's pretty wild-eyed the way people go at it. So, all these Middle Eastern powers, of course, are the focus of the Old New Testament. Now comes the German Wehrmacht, the war machine, into the picture, and Hitler. So immediately he becomes the great scourge of Europe. And they're thinking, all right, so here comes Hitler. He's coming down from the north. Right? And, of course, they label Hitler with all the adjectives that are given in the Bible for the great Antichrist, or the scourge of the earth. Okay, now, moreover, the German Empire, as I think I explained last week, was an outgrowth of Italy, Rome. When Rome fell, there emerged in its place a loose association of political units running from Italy clear up to the Baltic through the Central Europe, a vast complex of independent political entities which were linked together in some common association called the Holy Roman Empire. That was not, in the military sense, an empire. It was not obviously holy, and it was really not Roman, but it was the Holy Roman Empire, nevertheless. Well, here is something emerging out of Rome, and everybody could number 10 political units. It would be easy to do, to go through Central Europe and identify 10 kingdoms. Just like today, they identify the 10 nations of the common market. This was such a natural. But you see, Hitler has come and gone. And Germany was not without hope. So we did not have to leave the German people. through the history of the world, those that were regarded as invincible empires, even the British Empire, that was the 19th century, was the British century. They ruled the world from palm to pine. They thought that was their destiny. And whereas generally they were benevolent in terms of their own homeland, there are some pretty hair-raising tales, historical data regarding their handling of the colonies and their handling of the rest of the world. Anyway, I would say, you see, empires have come and gone. Of course, there was Alexander the Great. All these empires have come and gone. Now I'm submitting to you this. You say, where are you going? The upshot of this thing is, here are the Russian people who were 1,000 years Christian before they were hit by this communist thing. If you want a reason, if you want to say why did God let them down, I'm not sure he let them down, but why did were the communists allowed to come in? An atheistic power, whereas the nation was Christian. May not be too difficult to see the answer to that. Because the religion of Russia, which was Christian, was at the same time what we call Eastern Orthodox. They were a branch of the Catholic Church, but an Eastern branch, and there were some differences in their theology, which we will not go into today. Now, nevertheless, they were Christians. But the church, the clergy, the hierarchy, so identified themselves with the aristocrats that when the communists came in to wipe out the inequalities, although I have to say that was a myth too, but I can't get into that. But when they were reorganizing the society, Russian society, they numbered the church with the aristocrats, just as France did in the French Revolution. In France, before the French Revolution, they had the three major estates, the nobility, the clergy, and the commoners, and the estates general, or état général, which was an advisory council to the king, made up of representatives of each of these estates. In those councils, the church and the nobility voted together always. The clergy and the nobility were one and the same. The commoners rose up against this combine, and the church went down and away with the aristocrats. And so in Russia, when the communists came in, the Bolsheviks, the Mensheviks were there first as the Menshevik overthrew the Tsar and tried to establish a democracy, a republic there in Russia. But the Bolsheviks, who were stronger, which represented the Communist Party under Lenin, the Bolsheviks overthrew the Mensheviks, and that's when the axe fell on the church. But the Bolsheviks opposed the church along with the nobility. You see that? And it was because the nobility so identified themselves with the church, clergy so identified themselves with the nobility that they were one and the same. Now, I'm just saying that to say to you that you can find a reason. You can say the church was not vital, and it did not see the handwriting on the wall, and it did nothing to help the commoner in his understanding of things, of life. The mujik, the peasant of Russia, was just a pawn in the game. And that was the fault. The clergy was at fault here. Well, they went down with the Tsar and the nobility of Russia. Now, maybe we ought to begin to pray that the Lord will bring about a recovery in Russia and not just give them over to the enemy. I've said all of this in terms of saying to you, we want to put together here an approach to life that doesn't run scared, that doesn't function on superstition, that doesn't function on the basis of revelationalism, for all that we know about what's going on in the world has got to come from some revelational thing, because that's too un- easy. It's too questionable. Who knows whose revelation is right? Can't go on that basis. We were talking about Christ. I want you to see your relationship to Christ not in terms of these spectacular things, in terms of the valid, vital, viable, daily presence of the Spirit of Christ within us, carrying us through so we cope with these things. We cope with the world around us. We don't wish it away. We don't drop a screen over it. We don't sprinkle Tinkerbell gold dust over it. We live in it. And our strength comes from the presence of the Spirit of Christ within us. And our peace with Christ comes not from changing everything, but holding steady in everything. Description of Christ in the first chapter of Revelation becomes meaningful to us when we are referred to the one who loved us and who washed us from our sins, or who rather loosed us. The King James says washed, and that's not the best. The older manuscripts, which are closer to the original text, use loosed rather than washed, who loosed us from our sins by His blood. And that means simply that the death of Christ was the necessary sacrifice to free us from God's judgments upon sin. I want you to understand, we're going to go next week into the issue of what is sin and what does it mean to be loosed from sin. And I just leave this word with you. In general, the word sin used throughout the Bible cannot be nailed down to particular things, but rather seems to be merely a missing of what is the mark, or missing the best. For example, Paul says, God forbid that I should sin in ceasing to pray for you. Well, that's not a gross violation of divine law. That's merely an infraction, a weakness that he's talking about there. Or he says, if my brother sin against me, how often shall I forgive him, and so forth. Well, we're not talking there about any violation of great divine principle. We're talking about offenses. We offend one another. Sin is really an offense. Now, God has not obviously, in freeing us from that, has not obviously taken away all sinning. Else Paul would not have said, God forbid that I should sin in ceasing to pray for you. He would have said, well, I'm already free from sin, so I won't sin. I don't have to pray about it. So God did not deliver us from sin in the sense that we are not going to make any more mistakes or offenses or offend anybody, but rather from the penalty of sin in the sense of the death that it brought into the world. In other words, no one in this world will die because of the offense or sin of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. That's all been wiped out. People that do not make it with Christ would be people who don't want to make it with Christ. Anybody today who says, I'd like to go along with Christ, has the opportunity. It's there. You don't even need a revival meeting to do it. Just go along with Christ. So anyone who has the desire can go with Christ. That frees us from sin. Sin is not there as the great barrier that keeps men from God. Nevertheless, we never have said that it's all right to sin. We've never said just because God took away the penalty of that there's no problem with it, because there are many reasons why we ought not to offend one another or God or ourselves. We'll talk about that next week. All of these things I've said are to give you hope that we're not just sitting here shaking, waiting for doomsday. We're vital people identified with Christ, and we have a grip on things. And God has His plan out there in the world. He's already exercised it over and over and over again in terms of His handling of world affairs. Just like that move of Constantine in splitting the Roman Empire was providential, no doubt about that. If you see the world through the eyes of the Spirit, you don't run around making all these wild speculations.